3-1 pitch, swing and a drive. Deep to right field, way up there, way out of here. Goodbye, baseball.
Eight strikeouts for the King tonight and make it 23 consecutive scoreless innings for Felix.
Strike three called on the outside corner, and there it is.
It's time for the Seattle Mariners Baseball Podcast.
Kyle Seager! That just happened! Thank you very much!
Now, here's your host, Gary Hill.
And welcome back once again to the Seattle Mariners Baseball Podcast. Gary Hill here. Still struggling through a voice thing, so bear with me here a little bit. But we have some good stuff to get to. The game yesterday, of course, not so good. We won't dive too much into that, believe me, as the Mariners, they get bashed by the Rangers 12-4, and they lose the three-game series to Texas. Off day coming today, too, so we won't dive too much into the Nationals coming up. That's going to come this weekend. That should be a lot of fun with Felix on Friday, but we'll get more into that on the podcast tomorrow. Do have a really good conversation coming your way, something I think is pretty interesting. Brian McPherson, who writes for the Providence Journal, wrote a pretty interesting article on payroll, correlation to wins, and how that compares to the mid-2000s till now. And it's pretty interesting, the stuff that he came up with in terms of correlation, payroll, and wins. So we're going to talk about that coming up in just a little bit. Going to end things with a Dave Niehaus read, which is an always a fun way to end things. And we'll also hear from Rick Waits, pitching coach for the Seattle Mariners. He's done such a great job through the season. And well, it's unfortunate, too. I've been talking so much about what the Mariners' pitching has been doing, just how consistent they've been. Their best 2 months in franchise history in terms of ERA, June of this year, July of this year, and then this month in August, they were on pace to shatter what they have ever done in terms of ERA in a month. They had a 2.17 ERA as a pitching staff coming into the game yesterday against the Texas Rangers. That was on pace. I mean, that's almost a half a run better than something they've ever done. There's only been a couple of teams since 1990 that's ever put up a month lower than 2.17. So we're talking historic terms, what they've been doing. But they gave up 12 runs yesterday, and they just blew that one away. Rasmo Ramirez getting the start for the Mariners, and generally had done his job in that slot, gone into the fifth, into the sixth inning, keeping the Mariners in the game and handing it over to the bullpen, you know, in that swingman, fifth and a half starter, sixth starter on the season. But that did not happen yesterday as he was bashed early.
Swing and he drives it to right field. Morrison racing back. He's nearing the shadows. He looks up, and this ball is gone. Rougned Odor thumps a homer here the third inning. He got every piece of that pitch from Ramirez, and this ball game has been blown open here in the Rangers' third inning. It's 8-1 Texas.
That was the big blow. And unlike other starts where we've seen Erasmo Ramirez on the hill, Lloyd McClendon has usually had the options of a full bullpen. And we've seen him at times have the quick hook with Ramirez. So even with Ramirez struggling early in the ballgame, with everything the bullpen has had to do, with all the heavy lifting they've had to do the past week or so, Lloyd McClendon just did not have that luxury to go to the bullpen early in this one. So Erasmo Ramirez ends up going three innings, gives up nine hits and those 10 earned runs. Mariners, though, they play some long ball as well. Mike Zunino, he'd hit a home run early and make a little Mariners history along the way.
The 1-1 pitch, swing and a high fly ball deep to left field. Going back, Michael Choice to the warning track. Wall looks up. Goodbye, baseball. Right over the top of Edgar's Cantina. Right over the top of the hand-operated scoreboard, and there's number 19 for Mike Zunino. The Mariners get on the board this afternoon. It's now the Rangers 4 and the Mariners 1 on Mike Zunino's 19th home run of the year.
Bullpen came on for the M's, and even the bullpen surrendered some runs in this ballgame, which is pretty rare. Joe Beimel has been he's been ridiculous this season. He's been so good, even he gives up a long ball.
The 0-1. Swinging, this is rocketed to right field. Morrison nearing the warning track. He's approaching the wall. He's running out of room, and it's gone. Beimel coughs up a two-run homer, and the Rangers just continue to pour it on here on a gorgeous day at Safeco Field. They lead it now 12-1.
What's remarkable about that home run is Bimal had only given up 5 earned runs on the season. He gave up a run July 13th. Before that, the last earned runs he'd given up April 26th. It's been a long, long, long time. So even the Rangers getting to Joe Bimal with that long ball. And then Kyle Seager, he hit number 20 on the season.
Colby Lewis delivers. Swing and a well-hit ball deep to right field. Line drive, and this one is gone. Goodbye, baseball. In and out of the seats, and there is number 20 for Kyle Seager. Third consecutive season, Seager with 20 or more home runs. And the last two to do it, Adrian Beltre and Raul Ibanez in a Mariners uniform. How about that? Number 20 for Kyle.
Yeah, number 20 for Kyle. Mike Zunino smashes number 19. He ties Miguel Olivo all time for home runs in a season by a Mariners catcher. 19 swats in the season for Zunino, but far outweighed by the Rangers and their onslaught as they pour it on and beat the Mariners by a final of 12-4.
So now coming out of it, the Mariners with a 2.59 ERA in the month of August as a staff, and still, if they finish with that, would be in the top three in franchise history in terms of ERA in a month, and it still leads Major League Baseball. So despite giving up 12 runs yesterday, the pitching staff still the best in the month of August. And after the game, Lloyd McClendon, he summed it up pretty plainly.
Yeah, not very good. Up in the zone. I was encouraged after the first inning. And for some reason, he started getting the ball up in the zone. And that's not a good thing, you know, against any team. So.
Better out, you know, more experienced outfielder, different player.
I'm not sure. That was a very difficult play. We talked about that in the dugout. I thought he gave it a great effort. You know, you're trying to catch, you're trying to avoid the wall. I'm not sure if Indy would have had that or anybody else. You know, that's just a tough play. He gave a great effort, and then he came back and made a great play, you know, on the dive. So, you know what I always say about those? The mistake was made 60 feet, 6 inches, not 400 feet away.
You said flush it and move on. Do you think your guys are going to be able to do that? I mean, they have so far this year, but should it be a problem?
No, that game's over with. We got a butts kick. That happens. Yeah, it hasn't happened very often to us this year. We've been just that good with our pitching.
So the Mariners try and turn the page. They'll take on Washington this weekend, and a very good team that I kind of talked about in the postgame show yesterday about Mariners have been fantastic against teams above 500, a winning percentage about 604. Meanwhile, they're below 500 against teams below 500. That's a trend that we talked about early in the season, but it continues. So we'll see what happens against Washington. As I know the Mariners anxious to turn the page after this one, off day today. We'll turn the page as well. And we're going to turn things over to Brian McPherson. He's a writer at the Providence Journal. You can find him, Brian Mac P, again, at Brian Mac P, writer for the Providence Journal, beat writer for the Boston Red Sox, also writes about baseball. This is a pretty interesting conversation. He's got a piece up at the Providence Journal about the correlation between payroll and wins. And we started talking about what did the correlation look like in the mid-2000s compared to what it looks like right now.
The advent of the internet age is that everything's preserved now. So we can go back about 15 years to these opening day payrolls. And in the mid-2000s, it wasn't, you know, an exact correlation, but you saw the wealthy teams win. I mean, the Red Sox and Yankees were in the ALCS every year. You know, the wealthy teams tended to win games because they were spending the big money on the free agents, and the free agents were paying off. You know, the Yankees were getting Alex Rodriguez. The Red Sox were getting Curt Schilling in a trade and signing him. They were getting Johnny Damon. Like, those sorts of deals were what were winning teams games. And now what you're seeing is that with these big-ticket free agents that are tending not to pay off, these guys, that especially in the advent of drug testing, just these guys after 30 who were not as productive as they were before 30, whether it's Albert Pujols, Josh Hamilton, you know, all sorts of guys that just aren't what you would expect them to be. Money isn't what it used to be in Major League Baseball, and the correlation between payroll and wins, as you can see by the standings, where, you know, these teams that don't have top five payrolls are in position to go to the playoffs. The correlation between payrolls and winning is just not even close to what it used to be.
Yeah, it's amazing when you look at it. I mean, you talk about the big four. I mean, only one of the top four payrolls right now is sitting in playoff position. And you look at a lot of the mid-tier teams are all in position right now to make it to the postseason. What has been the change from the mid-2000s to right now?
I think the drug testing is the big one, because what that's done is dragged down the age at which players are productive. You know, when the Angels signed Albert Pujols, like, maybe you didn't think he was going to be productive through age 40, but you figured, you know, he would be productive at least for a few years, and he just fell off the table. Just like when the Red Sox signed Carl Crawford, you figured he'd be productive for the first few years of that contract at least, and he wasn't. I mean, the Mariners have to be feeling pretty good about Robinson Cano right now. He's been one of the exceptions, even if his power's down. I mean, you can attribute that to the ballpark, but otherwise he's as good as he's been. And he's one of the few big-ticket free agents who's actually worked out for a team that signed him. Prince Fielder, you know, was a disappointment in Detroit. The list just goes on. And it does seem like that's attributable to drug testing, whether it's steroids and it's everything else, too. The thing that, you know, some of the amphetamines and things like that would keep guys going through a long season, especially the older players. And now young players are the currency of the game. You're seeing that everywhere. The teams that have the best young players are the teams that are winning, and money just can't get you young players, because teams have young players. They're not going to sell them for money, because money's not going to get them other young players. And the teams with the best young pitching, the best young position player, certainly, you know, a player like Felix Hernandez, you know, the Mariners certainly were able to pay him and keep him, but to get a Felix Hernandez, you know, especially the way the rules are set up now with the draft, with the international signing, the way to get those guys is not by being the highest spender. It's just by being the best scouting team or having the prime draft position for some of these guys.
I think you make a great point, too, about the team that you cover, the Boston Red Sox. It's interesting, with such a big market club, yet to make their World Series run a year ago, they jettisoned payroll instead of making the big money acquisitions. It was interesting how that played out, and then they go on and win the World Series, of course.
Yeah, and that's part of the reason I started looking into this, because you look at the upcoming free agent market, there's not a lot there, and Red Sox fans, yeah, they've seen two last-place finishes in 3 years now, sandwiched around a World Series title, so it's been kind of a weird sequence anyway. But this team that's in last place, the fans are going to say, look, we pay the highest ticket prices in baseball. You've got $175 million payroll. You've got money coming out your ears. Fenway Park, Nesson, they've got revenue everywhere. They've got plenty of money to spend, so make this team better. And then you look around and you figure, what are they going to do with this money? Because the position player free agents just aren't there, and there's some pitching guys, but you know, you have to be leery of the way these free agents end up working out. That's why they were reluctant to sign John Lester and traded him, was because they were skeptical of how things would go for John Lester, in, you know, even in his early 30s, let alone his mid to late 30s. So that's why they didn't make that deal. It wasn't because they couldn't afford it. It's because those players have tended not to work out. So that's a big part of why they just signed the Cuban defector, Rusne Castillo, that he's a guy in his prime years. And they probably overpaid him. I think the jury's out. I mean, certainly the jury's out, because you haven't seen him play in the U.S. yet. But it doesn't sound like he's going to be a star per se. They gave him $70 million, though, because they have money to spend and not a lot of great ways to spend it. And the idea is the better bet is on a guy in his prime years. He's 27. That's when you want to be signing a guy. But most guys are not available when they're 27. Most guys are getting a free agency when they're 31.
It's a great point, too. And a guy like Felix Hernandez, we're seeing that more and more, where teams are locking up their young stars, extending them longer when they can, so they even get to free agency longer. And you mentioned there's just not a lot of guys out there. You look forward to next year, and it's thin once again. So is that the adjustment that large market teams are going to make, spend where they can? And right now it looks to be the international market.
Yeah, there's a lot of different ways you can do it. You're right. There's these teams that usually wouldn't be locking up these guys. I mean, Seattle's been a financially competitive team, you know, at times in its history, but there are other teams like, you know, Cincinnati locking up Joey Votto and Jay Bruce, and Colorado locking up Tulowitzki and Carlos Gonzalez, even Tampa Bay locking up Evan Longoria. You know, Longoria is getting the 6 years this year. He'd be a free agent if the Rays hadn't been able to sign him, but there's been so much more revenue around the game, the Rays were able to sign Evan Longoria, you know, and that, I mean, the first contract, obviously he was under contract anyway to a ridiculously team-friendly contract, but they've got him basically for life now with that second $100 million deal that he signed, and that just means those players aren't around. So, yeah, you have to find more creative ways. Right now, it's the international market. The Yankees certainly blew everyone away to get Masahiro Tanaka. The Red Sox signed Castillo. You know, the other thing, too, is some of these, you know, complimentary guys are getting overpaid. You know, the Red Sox signed Shane Victorino a couple of years to a $39 million contract that a lot of people said was an overpay. But it's a similar situation that if you've got money to spend, you know, you have to spend it somewhere. And if there's a guy that you want, even if it's not the most efficient way to use your money, you use your money because there's no other way to use it. So they got Victorino probably at too high of a price, but they won a World Series because he was the right guy who fit. And, you know, a team that has money is not going to quibble over an extra few million dollars. You overpay for the complementary players because the core star players, they're not going to be out there because, yeah, like you said, you know, I could keep listing guys, Andrew McCutchen in Pittsburgh. Mm. You know, you wouldn't have thought that Pittsburgh would be able to sign their core guy going forward, but they've done that. Those sorts of star players just aren't in the free agent market anymore. You're not seeing them. Maybe you'll see Jason Hayward get there next year. Maybe you'll see Giancarlo Stanton get there in 2 years, but there's still no guarantee. Even though they'll get there, there's just not the star caliber talent out there the way there used to be when guys like Alex Rodriguez in their prime were hitting free agency.
Visiting here with Brian McPherson. You can find him on the Providence Journal and on Twitter as well, at Brian MACP, covers the Red Sox on a daily basis as well. So is this going to be a trend that continues out into the future as you see it?
At this point, yes. I mean, I don't know where the finances of baseball is going at this point, that, you know, whether the money will keep going up and the small market teams will keep catching up. Certainly, I think Bud Selig's made a priority of, you know, dealing in parity and trying to make sure that every team has similar access to players. And so far, the collective bargaining agreement has been that it takes players 6 years to get to free agency. And as long as that's the case, as long as guys are needing 6-7 years to get to free agency, at this stage, you know, they're playing their athletic primes for the team that drafted them. And the money doesn't matter in the draft anymore because they've restricted that so heavily. It used to be the Red Sox did this all the time, was to overpay in the draft to get guys who were going to go to college instead to sign and go to pro ball. When they drafted John Lester out of Tacoma, he was going to go to Arizona State, and they gave him an bonus above where, you know, his draft slot would have been recommended. And he signed instead, and he's obviously been he was a huge part of a couple of World Series for them. That even that's now been clamped down on, and teams can't spend too much money on the draft. So it seems like it's by design that this parity is happening. And as long as the prime ages stay, you know, as long as the performance-enhancing drugs are out of the game, the prime ages stay 27 to 30, as long as it takes until guys get through those years. You know, if you aren't coming up to the major leagues by the time you're 20, like a Mike Trout did, like a Felix Hernandez did as well, that he certainly, had he not signed, he would have hit free agency in his late 20s rather than at 30. But most guys are coming up when they're 23, 24, 25, and that means they're not hitting free agency until they're 31, and that means they're not in position to cash in until their best years are behind them. And that means that when they're signing those contracts, they're probably overpaid. They're not as effective as they used to be. And that means the teams that are able to kind of swim in that pool aren't really able to maximize their dollars because the players they're signing, their best years are already behind them.
That's a great point. In your opinion, lastly, is this good for the game, or is it better to have the big behemoths at the top?
I mean, it's good for the game in that, I think you don't want just whoever has the most money to win every year, because that's certainly discouraging for small market franchises. And it also promotes, you know, scouting is now the currency, being able to find the right guys. The fact that the Angels found Mike Trout, you know, that was a franchise-changing moment for them to dig him out of the first round. And rather than just saying, you know, like the Yankees getting Tanaka, you know, it's just less fun, it seems like, that if the team that has the most money to spend signs the best players, you know, there's not really any skill involved in that. Whereas, you know, when the Angels find a Mike Trout, they earned that. That was a guy that 24 teams passed on. At least one team passed on him twice. And, you know, but that was a scouting coup. Yeah. You know, we can all see how good Mike Trout is now, but that was a skill. That was somebody finding him, taking a shot, and drafting the right guy. And that's, you know, that's more in the spirit of competition than just, you know, we play in the biggest city with the biggest, you know, TV market and all of that, have the most revenue, so we get the best players. It's certainly more fun, though. I think, you know, I cover the Red Sox, a team in a big market, and I think, if you pulled the fan base that I cover, I don't think they'd see it the same way. I think they'd just assume the Red Sox be able to sign great players again that are going to change the franchise, like when they were signing, you know, Johnny Damon and bring in Keith Foulke and bring in Curt Schilling and Manny Ramirez and those guys that were winning them World Series.
Now, you make a good point, too, and it's certainly good to see a team like Kansas City, who hasn't been there in so long, fighting for a postseason berth, even Toronto that's been around. Seattle hasn't been there for a while. Milwaukee in the mix as well. It's certainly been a fun year with all those teams involved in the race. Brian, excellent piece. I enjoyed it. I enjoyed this conversation quite a bit. We'll do it again down the road. Thanks a lot for the time.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
That was Brian McPherson. Again, you can find him at the Providence Journal. That's where you can find that article that he wrote if you want to read it for yourself. And you can find him on Twitter as well, at Brian MacP. Very interesting conversation there about payroll. Good stuff. We're going to turn our attention now to the Mariners pitching coach, Rick Waits. Shannon, a chance to catch up with Rick for a couple of moments, and primarily talking about James Paxton, we saw just the other night, and what his potential can be down the stretch.
Shannon Dreher here at Safeco Field, catching up pitching coach Rick Waits. And Rick, boy, that was something watching James Paxton out there last night. You told me a couple of weeks ago that this guy is somebody that we can lean on down the stretch, and it looked like we saw that. Seeing him go 118 pitches last night, still throwing 96 in that seventh inning, he looks very strong and very fresh right now.
Well, you know, one thing I've always known about James, even when he was coming up through the minor leagues, is that we kind of did have a pitch count on him, like we have a lot of guys, and to develop him. But he'd sometimes get 100 pitches in the minor leagues, and he would be just as strong, if not stronger, than the early part of the game. So that's a good trait for a major league pitcher, to be able to maybe go 9 innings and get those extra pitches that he needs. I was really impressed on how in the middle of the game he really came together last night.
Yeah, it was great talking to him in that he put zeros up, but he said, I can work on this and this and this right now.
Yeah, and you know, he's at the point now where, you know, all four pitches are a good part. I mean, it's not that he's working on any one pitch over the other. He's got them all four there, and it's just a matter of being consistent from inning to inning. And, you know, last couple of games he's been inconsistent a little bit from inning to inning with all four pitches. Last night he had all four pitches going.
Lloyd McLennan said he needed to pitch last night, and it was great that he had that opportunity with the zeros and the runs to be able to stay out there.
Well, you know, one thing about a starting pitcher that a lot of guys don't get to experience like we did, you know, 20 years ago, is when you shake hands with the catcher at the end of a game, 9 innings, that is the greatest feeling. And so, therefore, young pitchers need to experience that in the major leagues. But if you can't get 9, then you need to know in your own mind mentally, I can go 7, I can go 8, I can give the team deep in the game, keep them in the game, win the game. It's a great feeling. And once you experience that, you want to do it all the time.
And that gave that pen a little bit of a rest. And it's one of the first times that it's looked like they've needed one in a while.
Well, you know, those tough weekend in Boston. You know, every team that goes into Boston for the weekend is always going to be tough. Great crowds there, you know, smaller ballpark, tough team. And, yeah, it wore our bullpen out quite a bit. And so it was a well-needed rest last night for our bullpen guys.
What a great opportunity to be in that environment and to be in those situations, regardless of who you're playing.
Oh, I think, you know, the innings that Leon pitched in Boston, even the innings of Farquhar, Williamson, Furbush, who have been here for a couple of years, to experience that going down the stretch here goes a long way.
That's Mariners pitching coach Rick Waits. And tomorrow Aaron Goldsmith is going to be on an off day, and we'll get you ready for Washington over the weekend as Felix Hernandez will take the hill. But we're going to end things now, as we do from time to time. A little Dave Niehaus read. These are always fun.
Fathers playing catch with sons. This is from Donald Hall. Fathers playing catch with sons. Suddenly, I remembered a scene in grave detail from the beginning of my baseball time. It's a Sunday afternoon, 1940, possibly 1941. When the Dodgers will win the pennant and meet the Yankees in the series, and I'll see the first game. My father and my mother and I are riding in the Studebaker, listening to Red Barber broadcast a crucial game between the Dodgers and the Giants. The Giants are ahead, and now the Dodgers begin to come close. Maybe they tie the game, I don't remember the details. And the Giants stop, pause, confer, and then they summon Carl Hubbell from the bullpen. My father explains how momentous it is that Carl Hubbell should pitch relief. Things have not gone well for him lately, but King Carl is the greatest left-hander of all time, who in the 1934 All-Star Game struck out Babe Ruth, Lou Gehrig, Jimmy Fox, Al Simmons, and Joe Cronin. all in a row. He's an old screwballer who walks always with his left elbow turned into his ribs, his arm permanently twisted by his best pitch. The great man seldom pitched relief, and now he walked from the bullpen to the pitcher's mound and took his tosses. Old man, who had pitched since 1928, who couldn't have more than three or four dwindling years left in his arm. Old man, come in to save the game for his faltering team. My father's face is tense. He loves the Dodgers and not the Giants, but he loves Carl Hubbell even more. My father is 37 years old in 1940. So is Carl Hubbell. Then the Dodgers send up a pinch hitter. It is Harold Reese, the baby shortstop, former Marbles Pee Wees champion of Louisville, Kentucky, fresh from the minor leagues and 15 years younger than Carl Hubbell. I sit in the front seat cheering the Dodgers on, hoping against hope, though I realize that the rookie shortstop is good field, no hit. Pee-wee hits a home run off Carl Hubbell, and the Dodgers win. Sitting there in the front seat, 11 years old, I clap and cheer, and then I hear my father's strange voice. I look across my mother to see his knuckles white on the wheel, his face white. I hear him saying, "The punk! The punk!" With astonishment and horror, I see that my father is crying. Donald Hall, father's playing catch with sons. We'll have more right after this.
See you later!